Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Thursday, March 24th. We'll get Masha Gessen's take now on the Ukraine war. The New Yorker correspondent's latest article is about Kharkiv, which has been one of the biggest targets of Vladimir Putin's scorched earth campaign against civilians. We will also ask Masha for their take on Putin becoming a hero to the global anti-LGBTQ right wing. Here's a clip of Steve Bannon and private security company head Eric Prince on a radio show a few weeks ago as the invasion was looming, seeming to really like Putin because he's anti-trans.
Putin ain't woke. He is anti-woke.
The Russians, people still know which bathroom to use.
They know how many genders are there in Russia?
Two.
Okay. That's all of a sudden. That's not. They don't have the flags. They don't have the pride flags outside on their.
They don't have boys swimming in girls' college swim meets.
How backward.
That was from Bannon's own podcast, and that's horrifying enough. And it was before the actual killing started taking place. We'll also ask Masha about one of her articles on how the Kosovo air war foreshadowed the crisis in Ukraine. Madeleine Albright, who died yesterday, the former Secretary of State, was very involved in President Bill Clinton's decision to bomb Kosovo when Serbian leaders were committing a genocide there against Muslims in Serbia in 1999. That genocide resulted in a war crimes conviction for their head of state, Slobodan Milosevic. Could that be a precedent for putting Putin on trial? Well, that's a lot. So let's see how much we can get to with New Yorker staff writer Masha Gessen. Their own background as a Russian immigrant to the United States includes being fired as editor of a Russian science magazine for refusing to send a reporter to cover hang gliding, that is Putin, hang gliding with Serbian cranes. And they won the National Book Award in 2017 for The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. Masha, we always appreciate when you come on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you for having me, Brian.
Well, not to bury the lead in terms of the impact on people's lives, your new article is about the devastation in Kharkiv. You say Kharkiv is now unrecognizable. For Americans who never heard of that city until this war, can you tell us what kind of a place Kharkiv was or has been?
So Kharkiv is the second largest city in Ukraine. It's just 25 miles from the border with Russia. It's always been sort of a gateway city, and for some of its existence, it was historically the gateway of the Russian Empire to the West. And then it became, for the last 8 years, it was a sort of a gateway for Ukrainians traveling to Russia, Russians traveling in and out of Ukraine. It was right next to the territories that were occupied by Russia from 2014 up through the present. And people in Kharkiv were acutely aware that there was a war going on. There was a shooting war for 8 years before the current invasion began.
In the east, yeah.
Right next door, right? Kharkiv is in the east.
Exactly.
So, and in fact, Russia's original ambition was very clearly to include, in 2014, to include Kharkiv in the occupied territories, which didn't work. So Kharkiv was utterly brutally attacked in the last few weeks. Of course, we can say that about a lot of Ukrainian cities. One of the things about Kharkiv that I think is important and that people didn't understand, and certainly Russia didn't understand, was that even though it's a traditionally Russian-speaking city, it is very much a Ukrainian city in the sense that there was a Ukrainian identity that was forged through over the 8 years of being right next to the occupation. And knowing the misery and carnage that the occupation caused, which is something that I think the Kremlin was willfully blind to. And so the kind of resistance that Russia has encountered in Ukraine kind of begins with Kharkiv.
Interesting.
As a very Ukrainian-identified city, a city that's going to certainly defend itself to the last.
And that was already suffering. You write about a voice message forwarded to you from Denis Kobzin, if I'm saying that right, the director of the Kharkiv Institute for Social Research, which said in part, it's the worst for vulnerable people, people who are ill, elderly, bedridden. There is no hope for them. There is no medication left, no nursing care, no medical help, and no chance of leaving the city. Emergency services are working around the clock, but they don't have enough equipment or enough people, unquote, from that voice message. Masha, that's consistent with other reporting I've been seeing about how it's largely senior citizens who Putin's bombs and missiles are killing, because the younger women and children have fled in large part, and the younger men are fighting in the war. Is Putin trying to bring Ukraine to its knees by killing sick and old people?
I think Putin is consistently and consciously creating humanitarian catastrophe in Ukraine. You know that when residential neighborhoods, when places like the theater in Mariupol, where people were sheltering in the basement, are targeted or shelled, you know that the vulnerable civilians will be disproportionately affected, right? They're targeting civilians, and those among the civilians who cannot make their way down to the bomb shelter, who cannot make their way out of the country, who cannot make their way out of the city, those are the people who will be disproportionately affected. So yes, it's the weak, the ill, the elderly, who are completely helpless as one of the world's largest armies unleashes its fury on them.
Just before the war really began, but the buildup was taking place of Russian troops near the border, one of your articles said both the Russian and Ukrainian governments kept downplaying the probability of war and reprimanding journalists for fanning the fear. Do you think President Zelensky and others in the Ukrainian government were genuinely surprised by the full-scale invasion Putin ordered, rather than containing it to the disputed eastern provinces?
It's hard for me to know what kind of intelligence Zelensky had, apparently, from all available information. He had excellent intelligence, and certainly U.S. intelligence continued to indicate that Putin was talking about a full-scale invasion. I think there's a difference between knowing and fully believing it. You know, I still can't believe this is happening. This is unthinkable. It's unimaginable, and it's happening before our eyes. Separately from that, the downplaying by the Ukrainian government just before the invasion was a very transparent strategy. They didn't know whether the invasion was going to happen for sure. They didn't know when it was going to happen. But talk of the invasion was destroying the Ukrainian economy before there was any shooting, right? And so they were asking journalists to stop fanning the flames of panic, mostly in order to protect their economy.
There are reports of growing disenchantment with Putin at high levels of the government, even though he's seems to be a in sole control of the government for the most part. Different people have said from the Soviet era premiers, who at least had a meaningful Politburo to check them. But these reports of growing disenchantment with Putin at whatever high levels of the government they refer to, since the war effort is failing to meet its original goals and looks so bad to the world, do you have any way to judge whether Putin could lose his grip on power through any individuals you may be familiar with in the Russian hierarchy?
I don't think that that the regime is vulnerable to displeasure among the elites. That is not the way it's structured. Basically, Putin is the padre of a mafia clan, where he's constantly distributing money and power to the people who surround him. The smaller this pie of money and power gets, the more sort of pushing each other aside with their elbows there happens in order to get closer to Putin, in order to get whatever remains of this little tiny pie. And you know, in that sense, the sort of the rhetoric behind Western sanctions, that they're created to prompt the elites to rebel against Putin, I think is it either reflects lazy thinking, or more likely it's just quite insincere, because U.S. intelligence knows enough to know that the possibility of a palace coup in Russia is vanishing small.
Hmm. That's going to be bad news to some of our listeners who may have been hanging on those reports as maybe the best hope. Here's a question from a listener via Twitter. It asks, why did Putin not do this when Trump was in office? I guess the implication there is Trump would have been more sympathetic to it and there wouldn't be this kind of NATO response.
You know, the world does not revolve around the United States. And I think the implication of that question is, oh, you know, they must have had something, you know, some kind of arrangement or whatever. I have very little patience with thinking that turns us away from what's actually going on the ground in Ukraine and Russia, and to so looking for conspiracy theories in the U.S. government. I don't know why he didn't do it while Trump was in office, because he felt more stable while Trump was in office, for Russian reasons that have nothing to do with Trump.
Yeah.
But to any substance of that question, I would say that Putin certainly did not expect that the war would drag on for so long. He clearly had faulty intelligence. His cronies promised him that they would be able to take Ukraine in a couple of days, or at least take Kyiv, the capital, in a couple of days. And he didn't expect the kind of devastating sanctions that have been imposed on Russia. But what he did expect was that there would be no NATO military response, and there hasn't been. You know, President Zelensky's pleas for a no-fly zone have gone unheeded and have even been treated with a kind of dismissive irritation by Western leaders, as though he were asking for something completely unreasonable when he's asking for Western help in protecting his people, who are being pummeled by Russian artillery and aviation, you know, as they try to hide inside their homes. He is asking for military intervention in the largest humanitarian catastrophe of our time. And his requests are being treated as unrealistic and unreasonable.
A question to that point, I think, from Roger in Tamworth, New Hampshire. Roger, you're on WNYC with Masha Gessen from The New Yorker. Hello.
Hello. I'm wondering if Masha thinks that Mr. Putin is trying to goad the West into a fight which he believes that he can win on a larger context.
Impression,
That's
Masha?
A great question. Yeah. The answer is I don't know. What I think is true is that Putin views himself as being at war with the West, right? And particularly with the United States. He also views sanctions as acts of war. We know this because he said so over and over again, right? And he sees the war in Ukraine as a proxy war. So as far as he's concerned, he's already in military conflict with the United States.
But the premise of the U.S. and NATO not getting further involved, like with a no-fly zone that Zelensky wants, or ways of sending MiG aircraft, is it would invite Putin to launch a larger war against NATO, and then there will be a lot more suffering than there even is today. And I wonder, you're not a military reporter, but if you have an opinion about that, there are some people, I guess, like the caller, who think maybe Putin thinks it is in his interest to goad the West into a wider war. There are other people who say he'd never cross that line because it would be military suicide.
I definitely do not believe that he would never cross that line. And the reason I don't believe that is because I listen to what he says, and what he says over and over again is that A, he sees himself as being already in conflict with the US, B, that he reserves the right to use nuclear weapons, that, you know, if you listen to Russian television, you keep hearing them talking about the use of military airports in Poland to supply aid to Ukraine. The message there is that Putin views those military airports as a legitimate military target, right? So there's absolutely no indication that Putin sees that as a line that he can't cross. You're right, I'm not a military expert. I'm not a military reporter. I certainly do not have a suggested solution to this. Mm-hmm. All I'm trying to say is that when we talk about not being pulled into a larger conflict, another way of saying that is, look, it is easier to tolerate Ukrainian civilians dying than to risk the death of NATO soldiers or to risk the deaths of people in NATO member countries, right? There's a hierarchy there. And that is, you know, hugely morally problematic.
A hierarchy of the value of different people's lives as perceived by the West, you're saying.
That is exactly what I'm saying.
Before we run out of time, you know, I played a clip at the beginning of Steve Bannon and Eric Prince kind of joking, kind of not joking about Putin being a good guy for being anti-LGBTQ, anti-trans in particular. In that clip, you've written about how you and your family left Russia in 2013 after the Russian parliament had voted unanimously to ban what it called propaganda of non-traditional sexual relations. Would you tell our listeners who may not know your story a little of it and where you think it fits into the larger arc of Putin's campaign against LGBT people?
Right. Well, my family had to leave Russia because the government was specifically threatening us with taking my adopted son out of the family because he was being raised in a quote-unquote perverted family. But anti-gay rhetoric has been a centerpiece of Putin's politics for a decade now, and it's very much a part of the anti-Western rhetoric that backs up the war, right? When he was talking about a week ago, when he was talking about people who are leaving Russia and needing to ferret out traitors within the ranks, he said, you know, these are people who can't live without foie gras, oysters, and gender freedom, which is very much his picture of the decadent.
Did you say foie gras, oysters, and gender freedom?
That's exactly what I said. For
putting those three together as if they're of a set.
Yes, and that's, you know, that's shorthand for the dying decadent West, which is a kind of centerpiece of this pseudo traditionalist politics, which is of course where Vladimir Putin's regime meets the U.S. and Western European far right.
So how do you see this war ending? Last question.
I have no idea. The best case scenario is awful. The best case scenario is that negotiations result in some kind of ceasefire or temporary peace treaty that gives Russia control over the southeastern part of Ukraine. That is awful because it is rewarding this act of heinous aggression, but it's also awful because it will be nothing but a temporary solution until Putin regroups and attacks again. And that's the best case scenario.
New Yorker staff writer Masha Gessen. Their latest article is about Kharkiv, which has been one of the biggest targets of Vladimir Putin's scorched earth campaign against civilians. Masha, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian? Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.